And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Whitcher. Today I'll be reading from The Maid of the North, Feminist Folk Tales from Around the World by Ethel Johnston Phelps. The Giant's Daughter, a Scandinavian tale. A long time ago, giants and trolls dwelt in the high mountain forests above the northern fjords. They kept to themselves and had little to do with the people who lived in the valley below, except to scare the wits out of one of them now and then. Gina was different. She was quite curious about the humans living in the little houses down in the valley and along the shore. Of course, she was still young, as giants go, and not fully grown. That would explain her foolishness, thought her father. She has the curiosity of a bear cub, grumbled her mother. But it's very unnatural to bother with humankind. Have nothing to do with people, advised the elder giants. Small, stupid creatures, frightened by a boulder thrown or a sheep carried off. Nonetheless, on clear days, young Gina would sit on a rock at the lower edge of the forest, watching the people below go about their daily work. It seemed to Gina that these people had a splendid time. The maidservants especially caught her attention, moving about from dairy to stream, laughing together as they worked. Huh, their work is so easy, I could do it with one hand, thought she. And so many kinds of food just for the taking. Gina, it must be admitted, was just a little greedy. She loved to eat. She was also quite stubborn. Once she had made up her mind to go down to the village below, no one could dissuade her. Her cousins, the mountain trolls, shrilled, "But they're our enemy! You'll be killed, and it will serve you right!" "Oh, you foolish child!" cried her mother in alarm. "Mark my words, there will be trouble. No good will come of it." "Oh, no good will come of it," warned the uncles, the aunts, and all the rest of the giants. But they were all quite wrong. One day, Gina, hop-skipping over the boulders, came down the mountain to the village. At the first two houses where she stopped to ask for work, she had no luck at all. At the third house, the mistress looked at the very tall, strongly built girl with a large, round head and thought, "Here's a bargain indeed, an odd-looking country girl, but she'll do very well for chopping wood and pounding the wash," when she told Gina to come in. Gina bent down, ducking her head to enter the house. "Oh, such queer, tiny houses," thought she. "Doorways much too small and roofs much too low for comfort." Gina was set to work at once, but it was not many days before the mistress regretted having taken in the strange girl. Gina chopped wood with a will, but so violently that the chunks flew in all directions. One struck a rooster stone dead, and one sent a dog yowling off in surprise. Another whacked a cart horse so sharply that he bolted off, spilling rounds of cheese right and left. And then she carried such huge armloads of wood into the house that the door burst off its hinges. Set to work with a tub of wash at the stream, she pounded the laundry so thoroughly that all the clothes and linens came out in rags. And to make matters worse, Gina ate more than all the other servants put together. Even between meals, she found her way into the storeroom and sat happily devouring jars of honey, vats of pickles, and long strings of sausages. The mistress brought this tale of woe to her husband, a merchant. "She's impossible," cried the mistress. "We must get rid of her. When she scours pots, she grinds holes in them, and when she washes dishes, she breaks half of them. If she sits on my chairs, they collapse. No, I can't keep her a day longer. She'll be the ruin of us." But if Gina was greedy about food, the merchant was miserly about money.
She's powerfully strong, and we pay her no wages, he pointed out to his wife. Regina knew nothing of money or wages. We could never get a village girl to work for us without payment. And where could we find one half so strong? Gina's twice as strong as a man. I'll find work for her. So, although the mistress complained bitterly about the havoc Gina caused and wanted to get rid of her at once, the merchant insisted she be kept on. He set Gina to heavy outdoor work, carrying bales of hay to the barn. But Gina thought it fun to toss the bales into the hayloft, and if she knocked down a farmhand in the process, she merely roared with laughter. If a horse kicked her, she gave the animal a powerful kick right back. All this caused such an uproar in the barnyard that the merchant quickly set Gina to unloading the fishing boats that came to his wharf. Here she did the work of two or three men. Delighted with such a strong and willing worker, the merchant used Gina everywhere, from sausage and cheese making to building a new storage barn. In the new barn, he had Gina build a room and bed of her own, for the mistress declared she was not fit to live in a house. The merchant, however, rubbed his hands in satisfaction, thinking of the money he saved. And what about Gina? Gina was enjoying herself. The heavy work did not bother her at all. She joined in the village dances, but she swung her partners with such vigor that they whirled away across the field. After that, partners were hard to find. Still, everything new fascinated her. Although she thought humans most peculiar in their ways, she marveled at their cleverness. Their houses were too small and their furniture too flimsy, but it was fine to sleep on a bed instead of a pile of leaves, or use an axe to chop wood instead of breaking it apart with her hands. And to think, one might keep chickens to have eggs whenever one wished. Her sharp, inquisitive eyes took in everything that went on around her. Things went on in this way for several months. But while the merchant became more and more pleased with his bargain, the mistress became more and more irritated with Gina. She determined to get rid of her. In the spring, the merchant prepared to sail down to Bergen on a trading voyage. His wife announced that she would go with him. And just before they set sail, she took Gina aside and said sharply, "I don't want to find you here when we return. I advise you to go back to wherever you came from." Then she quickly joined her husband aboard the ship, and they sailed away down the fjord with a stiff breeze. Gina was left on shore with the village folk who had turned out to see the merchant off. Next to her stood two maidservants from the village. "Wish you were going with them," said one. "Save the money they pay you, Gina, and you can go to Bergen yourself someday." "Money they pay me?" repeated Gina in surprise. "Your wages for working," said the other. "I noticed you never spend any money. You must have a nice little sum hidden away." "They never gave me any money for working." The two girls laughed at her. "Oh, you are a green one. You worked almost a year for nothing." "Greedy old man," said the other. "No wonder he's so rich." When Gina finally understood that all the other country girls were paid, her eyes became quite red with anger. She stalked back to the merchant's place, and there she sat down and thought for a long time. "Payment I shall have," she said finally. "I'll take it myself." At once she set to work. She pulled out an old cart from the barn and loaded it with all the things she had decided to take with her. In went a cock and a hen, an axe, nails. She knew what she needed for the success of her plan. And when the cart was filled, she didn't forget to toss in a round wheel of cheese, a crock of pickles, and several strings of her favorite sausages. Then she pulled the loaded cart up the mountain until she reached the high pine forests, the land of the trolls and giants. Swinging the axe with gusto, she soon converted trees into the framework of a tall one-room house. She made sure that the doorway was big and wide, and the roof high enough for a full-grown giant. Next to it was a fenced-in yard for the cock and hen. From time to time, the giants and trolls came by to watch her work and to gape in astonishment at so much mad activity. "Poor Gina," they said to each other. "She's become as crazy as a loon living with humans all that time. I knew no good would come of it." "She'll never marry now," lamented Gina's mother. "She's collected no fur pelts or diary. What sensible giant would want that pile of wood?" But again, they were all quite wrong. When Gina had finished all her work, the first frost sparkled on the ground and the smell of snow was in the air. She now had a tall house made of logs, snug against the winter cold. She had an open hearth and a stack of firewood, a big, solid chair, a large bed covered with fur pelts, chickens safely housed in a lean-to, rounds of cheese made from wild goat and reindeer milk, sausages and wild boar hams hanging from the rafters. By the time the heavy snow had settled on the mountain, even the sour trolls had to admit that a warm log house was better than a cave or a deep underground hole. It dawned on the folk of the forest that Gina was not crazy at all. She was, in fact, very clever. And what better dowry could a young giant girl have than a snug hut and strings of fragrant sausages? All the giant folk now called her Clever Gina. And as the winter thawed into spring, Gina was besieged with offers to marry.
"Perhaps I'll marry, perhaps I won't," she said carelessly. "I'll think about it."
And since the young giants were very eager to bring her rabbits or wild boar and other game in exchange for eggs, cheese, or the loan of her axe, it seemed to Gina that thinking about it was a very good arrangement indeed. You've been listening to a story from the book The Maid of the North, Feminist Folk Tales from Around the World by Ethel Johnston Phelps, published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Ellen Whitcher.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hassler. Today I'll be reading from the book The Unbroken Web, Stories and Fables by Richard Adams. The Robin. Sermons are too long when you're 7, aren't they? As a matter of fact, they're sometimes too long when you're 37. And I dare say, if Grandpa were here, he might say, when you're 77. Don't worry. You've done me a good turn. Anyway, there's no virtue in trying to listen to a lot of stuff you can't be expected to understand. Padre Wood's coming to tea on Tuesday, and he'll tell you the same thing himself, I dare say. Let's sit down in the sun, shall we, on this nice flat tombstone. Wait for them to come out. I don't suppose they'll be very long. Whose tombstone is it? I wonder. Let's have a look. Beneath this stone are deposited the mortal remains of Thomasina Francis, beloved wife of Horatio James Cremorne, physician of St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, and of this parish, who departed this life in her 70th year on 23rd April in the year of our Lord 1795. A cherished mother, an amiable spouse, and a congenial friend, she deserved and obtained the admiration and esteem of the whole society. There shall be no more death, for the former things are passed away. Well, I think poor old Dr. Cremorne must have taken a lot of trouble over that, don't you? I suppose he wrote it himself. It may sound a bit old-fashioned now, but I'm sure his feelings were just as real as anyone's today. Oh, look, there's a robin over there on that flowering currant bush. I've got a dog biscuit here in my pocket, just a moment. I generally carry one on Sundays for old Tinker. Mrs. Fleet was Tinker, you know. Well, I know it's Good Friday, same thing, only different, as they say. Here, let's break it up a bit and see if he comes and takes the crumbs. He will scatter them on this other tombstone over here, and see what happens. Yes, there you are. He's on it, sharp as a knife. Isn't he tame? There's usually a resident robin in the churchyard, you know, especially one that isn't full. They're quiet, undisturbed places, you see, with flowers and bushes that attract insects. And, of course, whenever the sexton has any digging to do, the robin can lend him a hand with the worms and the beetles. In fact, it may very well be the sexton that made this fellow so tame. Robins are lucky, you know. No one in his senses harms a robin. There's an old legend about him. My nurse, Constance Cripps, her name was, she told me the story a long time ago. She didn't say she believed it, but when I asked her, she wouldn't say that she didn't either. She said that long ago, on that first Good Friday, when Jesus was condemned by Pontius Pilate, there was a robin living near the gate of Jerusalem. He used to peck about at the side of the road and pick up crumbs from the camel drivers and market people who were always coming and going. Well, he saw the crowd coming out of the gate that morning, and the soldiers in the middle of it all. And he saw this poor fellow Jesus and the other two dragging their crosses up the road. Dreadful sight. Of course, he didn't know what it was all about. But he could see that everyone was being unkind to this fellow Jesus and shouting and throwing things. And he felt sorry for him because he thought he looked a kind sort of a man, and because he was all alone and helpless among those soldiers. And the robin was frightened of the noise and the crowd, but all the same he couldn't help wondering what was going to happen. And so he flew along in the hedges and bushes beside the road and kept up with the soldiers. When they got to Calvary, he stayed a little way off, but he was near enough to see what happened. After a time, he felt he couldn't bear to stay there and not try to help Jesus. So although he was still frightened, he flew up to the cross and began trying to pull out the nails. But of course he couldn't do that. They only hurt his beak. But after trying as hard as he could, he flew up to Jesus' head and began pulling out the thorns. Well, at that point, one of the soldiers picked up a stone to throw at the robin, but the centurion stopped him, told him just not to do it, and said that no one was to hurt the robin or drive him away. We know that this centurion felt sorry for Jesus, and that during that day he became convinced that he was indeed the Son of God, because three of the four Gospels all tell us that. The Gospels don't give us his name any more than they give us the names of the wise men. But in all the old legends and stories, his name is Longinus. Before he died, Jesus blessed the robin and promised that forever after, whenever they saw him, people would remember what he had done. He was all covered with Jesus' blood, which had dried on his breast feathers, and from that day to this, his breast has remained the color of dried blood. He was still there at the end of that terrible afternoon when Longinus and the soldiers took Jesus' body down and gave it to Joseph of Arimathea to lay in the sepulcher. And as Longinus had fed him and treated him kindly, the robin followed him back to the city and took to living in his garden, where he soon got so tame that he often used to come in through the window to pick up crumbs and bits of food. Now the legend says, it's part of the King Arthur story actually, and one day I'll read it to you in Mallory, that Longinus and Joseph of Arimathea became great friends and were among the first Christians and followers of the disciples. But after a time, they grew afraid of what Pontius Pilate and King Herod might do to them, so they decided to leave the country. In the Middle Ages, people used to believe that they sailed together to England, and that with them they brought three things: a piece of the cross, the spear with which Longinus had pierced Jesus' side after he died, and the Holy Grail, the cup. Yes, the cup which Jesus had blessed at the Last Supper. The legend says that the piece of the cross was planted at Glastonbury in Somerset, and from it sprung up the holy Glastonbury thorn, which was believed to bloom at midnight on Christmas Eve. The Grail was mysteriously received into heaven, but was later revealed to three of King Arthur's knights. They were Sir Galahad, Sir Bors, and Sir Percival. And what became of the spear, I don't remember to have heard. But the robin. Yes, the robin came to England too. Longinus had become so fond of him and his red breast that he made him a little cage and he sailed with them on the ship. And when they reached England, they let him go. And ever since then, he's lived near people's houses and brought them good luck. And often he's so tame that he'll come in through the kitchen window and sometimes even feed out of your hand, just like Longinus's robin. If you're digging in the garden, he'll come and peck about in the newly dug ground. And he never leaves England, even in the hardest winter weather. Why, the unluckiest thing you can do is to harm a robin, or let your cat hurt one. When the early settlers went to America, they missed the robin very much. There aren't any over there, you see, and so they gave the name robin to another bigger bird, which happens to have a chestnut-colored breast, although it's not much like the English robin. It's actually sort of a thrush, the Turdus migratorius, and its habits are quite different from our robins. Of course, we oughtn't to get these legends mixed up with the really important stories in the Gospels about Jesus and the disciples, but all the same, they are beautiful and worth remembering, because they show that ordinary, simple people in the old days used to feel very deeply about Jesus and connect things in their own lives and surroundings with him. Ah, here they all come back. Look, like sparks up the backs of a chimney, as my father used to say. My goodness, look. Look at Mrs. Fleetwood's new hat. Do you mind if we just wait a minute or two? I want to have a word with Padre Wood about the new nets for the cricket field. You've been listening to a story, The Robin, from the book The Unbroken Web, Stories and Fables by Richard Adams, published by Crown Publishers. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Tom Hassler. Thank you.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Whitcher. Today I'll be reading a tale from The Story Bag, a collection of Korean folk tales by Kim So-eun. The Silver Spoon. The only son of a wealthy family had a tutor to help him in his studies. The tutor was a fine scholar, but he had only one eye, and his nose was somewhat crooked. Because of this, the servants of the house continually made fun of him. Even the food which the servants brought to him morning and night was not like that served the others. When he asked for anything, the servants would pretend they'd not heard him. He would have to ask two or three times before the servants would do his bidding. The tutor was greatly troubled by the way the servants treated him. But even more troubled was the young man of the house, the tutor's pupil. "I can't bear to see my tutor made fun of like this," he thought. "I've thought of a plan that will teach the servants a good lesson." The young master slipped quietly into the kitchen so as not to be seen by the servants and took from the kitchen cupboard his father's favorite silver spoon. Next morning, the servants were in an uproar. The kitchen maids were white with fear. What would happen to them if the master were to learn of the loss of the spoon? The servants consulted a witch. They also went to see a fortune teller to see if he might not tell them what had happened to the spoon and where it could be found. But neither witch nor fortune teller were of any help. The servants searched high and low. The house was a welter of confusion. The young man, with the most innocent expression on his face, casually asked one of the servants, "What's the matter? Everybody seems so upset this morning." "Oh, upset is not the word. The master's silver spoon is missing." The youth suppressed his laughter and said, "Oh, why, what a terrible thing. I wonder what could have happened to it. Well, if we knew, we wouldn't be in such a state now." "Oh, that is bad." The youth was quiet for a while, as if in deep thought, and then he suddenly brightened, as if struck by a good idea, and said, "Ah, I know. My tutor is an amazing fortune teller. He would surely be able to help you." The servants had always made fun of the one-eyed, crooked-nosed tutor, but now they could do nothing in their plight but go asking for help. The servants then did as the young master suggested. First, they served the tutor a special dinner with wine and the best of food to put the tutor in a good mood, and then the chief servant said, "The master's silver spoon has disappeared. Will you tell us where it is to be found?" "What? You say a spoon has been lost? And the tutor cocked his head in thought while he plied the wine glass to his lips in pleasure. "Oh, please," the servant implored, "you must help us. I'm sure you can help us." And he bowed humbly many times before the tutor. "Wait, wait. Oh, I shall try," the tutor said condescendingly. He sat down before his desk and pretended to be reading the future. After a while, he said confidently, "Well, well, the spoon is hidden quite near the house. Yes, it is under a stone that lies in a southeasterly direction. Let's see, a stone to the southeast. That must be the stones beside the well. Yes, that's it. If you look under the stones by the well, I'm sure the spoon will be found." The servants immediately went to the well side and searched under all the stones, and there, sure enough, was a silver spoon. Of course the spoon was found there. Everything had been planned long in advance by the youth. He himself had taken the spoon and hidden it under the well stones. He had, of course, told the tutor of his scheme and where the spoon had been hidden. But the servants knew nothing of this scheming. Thus they naturally came to regard the tutor as a superior being. The servants, who up till then had been making fun of the tutor behind his back, now suddenly changed and began treating him with great respect. When mealtime came, the food served the tutor was much better than that served anyone else. Each time the servants brought in the food on trays, the youth and the tutor would look at each other and smile quietly together. Well, all good things are followed by bad, so the saying goes, and in the case of the tutor, a matter of great concern arose. After the silver spoon was found, the story of the tutor's magic powers spread throughout the house. It finally reached the ears of the head of the house. Now, the young student's father, the master of the house, was a state minister in the king's court. Just at that time, in the neighboring country of China, the Chinese emperor lost his official seal. The whole country was in a turmoil. Unless the emperor recovered his seal, he would have to give up his throne to another man. All the fortune tellers and the soothsayers in China were gathered together, yet not one of them could tell who had stolen this valuable seal. A messenger was then sent to Korea, who, after explaining the situation to the king, asked, "Please send us your very best soothsayer." The king called his state ministers together to consider who should be dispatched to China. One of the ministers spoke up. It was the father of the youth who had hidden the spoon. "We have a tutor who just recently located the whereabouts of a lost silver spoon. He is supposed to be a very famous fortune teller. What about sending this tutor of mine?" "That's most fortunate. And let's follow your advice." And the other ministers of state all agreed to this suggestion. The youth's father returned home and called the tutor before him. "It will be a hard trip, but I would like you to go to China on a mission," the minister said. And then he told the tutor in detail the story of the Chinese emperor's loss of his imperial seal. "Oh, no, not me. It's absurd," the tutor said, and declined over and over again. However, the minister had undertaken to send a soothsayer to China, and he simply wouldn't take no for an answer. He was fully convinced the tutor was a great soothsayer. "The greater a man, the more humble he is," the minister thought. Take this tutor, for instance. Although he had the power to tell at one crack where the silver spoon had been hidden, not even once had he made known his ability. The tutor simply acted as any ordinary man would act. Thus, the minister was convinced that the tutor really was an extraordinary soothsayer. "Oh, you don't have to be shy," the minister said. "Please do go, I beg you. There's nobody except you who can undertake this grave mission. Also, they say they will reward you with 100 gold pieces. If you should succeed in finding the seal, imagine the honors that will be heaped upon you." In this way, the minister finally forced upon the tutor the task of going to China, whether he would or no. The tutor did not care a thing about the reward of 100 pieces of gold, but he could hardly bear the thought of the shame that would come to him when he was exposed. Of course, he thought, even if he could bear the shame, when they found out he had lied about his abilities, he would certainly be punished heavily. "This is a terrible predicament," he thought, with pain in his heart. He went back to his room to ponder over the difficult position in which he found himself. A few minutes later, his pupil came into his room, all smiles. "Oh, you needn't worry, tutor," he said. "This is what I would do." And then the young lad put his mouth to the tutor's ear and began whispering to him in a very low voice. The tutor kept nodding his head and saying, The worried expression on his face gradually disappeared, and suddenly a cheerful smile lit up his features. The tutor did not reveal his plans to anyone. He completed his preparations and then departed with the emissary from the Chinese court. The two crossed the Yellow River and entered China. When they reached the Chinese capital, the tutor was ushered into the emperor's presence. In a voice filled with confidence, he told the emperor, "I shall find the seal for you within 3 months, so please put your mind at ease about it." The emperor was very pleased and answered in a cheerful voice, "I cannot thank you enough." Then the emperor commanded that the tutor be treated with all due respect and his residence be closely guarded lest any mishap overtake him. 2 months soon passed for the tutor, who was living a life of luxury and splendor. Each morning he went through his act of telling fortunes and divining the whereabouts of the seal. One morning, after he had gone through this act, the tutor sighed with great concern and murmured, "Oh, a terrible thing has happened." Someone nearby who had overheard his words asked, "What's the matter?" "Oh, nothing to trouble you with,"
about the house, but the votive tablets of my ancestors were all destroyed, too, the tutor answered, as if he had actually been at the scene of the fire. Can you tell such things, too? The person asked in surprise. Of course I can. If I couldn't tell such things, I wouldn't have come all this distance to look for the Emperor's lost seal. The tutor's answer was so surprising that the person was filled with doubt. Even if the tutor were the best fortune teller under the sun, he surely wouldn't be able to tell of a fire which happened thousands of miles away. And to say that the name tables of his ancestors were also destroyed, how could anyone believe such a thing? The person went straight to the Emperor and told him of the incident. The Emperor decided to send a messenger to Korea. The messenger was dispatched ostensibly to pay the Emperor's sympathies to the tutor's family, but actually the Emperor wanted to find out for sure whether there had really been a fire on that day. After a while, the messenger returned with a report that there actually had been a fire on the very day the tutor had said. In addition, the messenger confirmed that the ancestral name tablets had also been lost, because the family had not been able to get them out of the house quickly enough. When this news got around, everyone in the capital was deeply impressed. The fortune teller from Korea is really a remarkable man. He even knew of a fire that had taken place thousands of miles away. And that isn't all. Once that fortune teller gets started, they say he can foretell events that will take place 100 years from now. Isn't he a remarkable person? He's sure to find the Emperor's seal. They say he already knows who stole the seal. Well, we can look forward to seeing the robber executed soon. Such tales spread quickly all over the city, with embellishments added here and there, until the capital buzzed with the supernatural powers of the wizard from Korea. The fire had actually been planned between the tutor and his pupil long before. They had set a date for the fire to take place, and the house had been set afire on schedule, so there really was nothing to marvel at. But the people of China, of course, did not know this. They thought the tutor was a god, and treated him as if he were one. As the story of the tutor's prowess spread throughout the country, the person most impressed was naturally the man who had stolen the Emperor's seal. Not only was he impressed, but also no little worried. The tutor had said he would find the thief within 3 months. The thief now felt that he must do something quickly. He knew he would be found out sooner or later, with the all-seeing eye of the tutor reading into the hearts and souls of everyone. So the thief said to himself, "If I'm to be found out eventually, I might as well give myself up now and ask for mercy. In this way, I might at least save my life." It was next to the last day of the 3 month period the tutor had set for himself. A man slipped fearfully into the tutor's room. He was the thief who had taken the Emperor's seal. Making sure that no one else was around, the thief bowed low before the tutor and said, "Please spare my life." His one eye flashing with anger, the tutor said, "You miserable fool! I was going to wait just one more day to see what you would do, and then I planned to go and tell the Emperor your name. But now that you have come out and confessed your crime, I shall have pity on you and spare your life." The thief was cowed by the solemn voice of the tutor, but with great relief he answered, "You will truly spare my life? Thank you from the bottom of my heart. The Emperor's seal is hidden at the bottom of the pool in the middle of the Imperial Palace grounds." "Well, I knew that from before," the tutor said sternly. "I shall close my eyes to your crime this time, but you must never do such a thing again." The tutor then sent the man home. Next day, the last of the 3 month period, the tutor appeared before the Emperor, who asked eagerly, "Have you discovered where the seal is hidden?" The tutor answered, "Of course. Your worries are all over. I shall have it in your hands this very day. However, you must promise never to ask me who stole the seal. If you do, I will not be able to return the seal to you." The emperor wanted the seal back so badly, he willingly agreed to the tutor's proposal. The seal is in the palace pool, the tutor said. Please have the pool drained. Immediately, workers were set to work draining the pool. 1,000 men busied themselves scooping out the water, and the bottom soon came into sight. And there the seal was. Thus, the seal was once again safe in the hands of the emperor. Thanks to the tutor, the entire country was freed from anxiety and fear. In addition to the promised 100 pieces of gold, the tutor was showered with many, many gifts. His mission successfully completed, the tutor returned once more to Korea. There his fame grew greater and greater than ever before. But his worries grew in proportion to his reputation. He could never tell when he would again be asked to tell fortunes or to divine secrets. Thus, he was still in danger of being found out. Once again, his pupil came up with a good idea. Tell the people that you are sick and stay out of sight for 1 month. After a month is over, tell them that you have recovered, that because of your illness, you have lost all your powers of divination. The tutor followed the youngster's suggestion and took to his bed. People kept coming from all over the country to ask for his help, but he refused to see any of them, saying he was ill. Then, blaming his illness, the tutor never again told any fortunes. As a result, he was able to spend the rest of his life in peace, enjoying the great wealth he'd brought from China. You've been listening to a tale from the Story Bag, a collection of Korean folk tales by Kim Soo-un, published by Tuttle. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella, and I'm Ellen Twitcher. And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Witcher. Today I'll be reading three old favorites from the Illustrated Treasury of Children's Literature, edited by Margaret Martignoni. The Husband Who Was to Mind the House. Once on a time, there was a man so surly and cross he never thought his wife did anything right in the house. So one evening in haymaking time, he came home scolding and swearing and showing his teeth and making a dust. Oh, dear love, don't be so angry. There's a good man, said his goody. Tomorrow let's change our work. I'll go out with the mowers and mow, and you shall mind the house at home. Yes, the husband thought that would do very well. So early next morning, his goody took a scythe over her neck and went out into the hayfield with the mowers and began to mow. But the man was to mind house and do the work at home. First of all, he wanted to churn the butter. But when he churned a while, he got thirsty and went down to the cellar to tap a barrel of ale. So just when he had knocked in the bung and was putting the tap into the cask, he heard overhead the pig come into the kitchen. Then off he ran up the cellar steps with the tap in his hand as fast as he could to look after the pig, lest it should upset the churn. But when he got up and saw the pig had already knocked the churn over and stood there rooting and grunting amongst the cream, which was running all over the floor, he got so wild with rage that he quite forgot the ale barrel and ran at the pig as hard as he could. He caught it, too, just as it ran out of doors, and gave it such a kick that Piggy lay for dead on the spot. Then all at once he remembered he had the tap in his hand, but when he got down to the cellar, every drop of ale had run out of the cask.
Then he went into the dairy and found enough cream left to fill the churn again, and so he began to churn, for butter they must have at dinner. When he churned a bit, he remembered that their milking cow was still shut up in the byre and hadn't had a bit to eat or a drop to drink all morning, though the sun was high. Then all at once he thought it was too far to take her down to the meadow, so he'd just get her up on the housetop, for the house, you must know, was thatched with sods, and a fine crop of grass was growing there. Now the house lay close up against a steep down, and he thought if he laid a plank across to the thatch at the back, he'd get the cow up. But still he couldn't leave the churn, for there was his little babe crawling about on the floor. And if I leave it, he thought, the child is sure to upset it. So he took the churn on his back and went out with it. But then he thought he'd better first water the cow before he turned her out on the thatch. So he took up a bucket to draw water out of the well, but as he stooped down at the well's brink, all the cream ran out of the churn over his shoulders and so down into the well. Well, now it was near dinner time, and he hadn't even got the butter yet, so he thought he'd best boil the porridge, and filled the pot with water and hung it over the fire. When he had done that, he thought the cow might perhaps fall off the thatch and break her legs or her neck, so he got up on the house to tie her up. One end of the rope he made fast to the cow's neck, and the other he slipped down the chimney and tied round his own thigh. And he had to make haste, for the water now began to boil in the pot, and he had still to grind the oatmeal. So he began to grind away. But while he was hard at it, down fell the cow off the housetop after all, and as she fell, she dragged the man up the chimney by the rope. And there he stuck fast. And as for the cow, she hung halfway down the wall, swinging between heaven and earth, for she could neither get down nor up. Well, now the goody had waited 7 lengths and 7 breadths for her husband to come and call them home to dinner, but never a call they had. At last she thought she'd waited long enough and went home. But when she got there and saw the cow hanging in such an ugly place, she ran up and cut the rope in two with her thighs. But as she did this, down came her husband out of the chimney. And so when his old dame came inside the kitchen, there she found him, standing on his head in the porridge pot. Lazy Jack. Once upon a time there was a boy whose name was Jack, and he lived with his mother on a common. They were very poor, and the old woman got her living by spinning, but Jack was so lazy that he would do nothing but bask in the sun in the hot weather and sit by the corner of the hearth in the winter time. So they called him Lazy Jack. His mother could not get him to do anything for her, and at last told him one Monday that if he did not begin to work for his porridge, she'd turn him out to get his living as he could. This roused Jack, and he went out and hired himself for the next day to a neighboring farmer for a penny. But as he was coming home, never having had any money before, he lost it in passing over a brook. "Oh, you stupid boy," said his mother, "you should have put it in your pocket." "I'll do so another time," replied Jack. Well, the next day Jack went out again and hired himself to a cowkeeper who gave him a jar of milk for his day's work. Jack took the jar and put it into the large pocket of his jacket, spilling it all long before he got home. "Oh, dear me," said the old woman, "you should have carried it on your head." "I'll do so another time," said Jack. So the following day, Jack hired himself again to a farmer who agreed to give him a cream cheese for his services. In the evening, Jack took the cheese and went home with it on his head. By the time he got home, the cheese was all spoilt, part of it being lost, and part matted with his hair. "Oh, you stupid lout," said his mother, "you should have carried it very carefully in your hands." "I'll do so another time," replied Jack. Now the next day, Lazy Jack again went out and hired himself to a baker who would give him nothing for his work but a large tomcat. Jack took the cat and began carrying it very carefully in his hands. But in a short time, Pussy scratched him so much he was compelled to let it go. When he got home, his mother said to him, "Oh, you silly fellow, you should have tied it with a string and dragged it along after you." "I'll do so another time," said Jack. So on the following day, Jack hired himself to a butcher who rewarded him by the handsome present of a shoulder of mutton. Jack took the mutton, tied it to a string, and trailed it along after him in the dirt, so that by the time he got home, the meat was completely spoilt. His mother was this time quite out of patience with him, for the next day was Sunday, and she was obliged to do with cabbage for her dinner. "Oh, you ninny hammer," she said to her son, "you should have carried it on your shoulder." "I'll do so another time," replied Jack. Well, on the Monday, Lazy Jack went once more and hired himself to a cattle keeper who gave him a donkey for his trouble. Now, though Jack was strong, he found it hard to hoist the donkey on his shoulders. But at last he did it and began walking home slowly with his prize. Now, it so happened that in the course of his journey, he passed a house where a rich man lived with his only daughter, a beautiful girl, who was deaf and dumb, and she had never laughed in her life, and the doctor said she would never speak till somebody made her laugh. So the father had given out that any man who made her laugh would receive her hand in marriage. Now this young lady happened to be looking out of the window when Jack was passing by with the donkey on his shoulders, and the poor beast with its legs sticking up in the air was kicking violently and hee-hawing with all its might. Well, the sight was so comical that she burst out into a great fit of laughter and immediately recovered her speech and hearing. Her father was overjoyed and fulfilled his promise by marrying her to Lazy Jack, who was thus made a rich gentleman. They lived in a large house, and Jack's mother lived with them in great happiness until she died. The Bremen Town Musicians. A certain man had an ass which for many years carried sacks to the mill without tiring. At last, however, its strength was worn out, and it was no longer of any use for work. Accordingly, its master began to ponder as to how best to cut down its keep. But the ass, seeing there was mischief in the air, ran away and started on the road to Bremen. There he thought he would become a town musician. When he had been traveling a short time, he fell in with a hound who was lying panting on the road as though he had run himself off his legs. "Well, what are you panting so for, Growler?" said the ass. "Just because I'm old, and every day I get weaker, and also because I can no longer keep up with the pack, my master wanted to kill me, so I took my departure. But now how am I to earn my bread?" "You know what," said the ass, "I'm going to Bremen, and shall there become a town musician. Come with me and take your part in the music. I shall play the lute, and you shall beat the kettle drum." The hound agreed, and they went on. A short time afterwards, they came upon a cat sitting in the road with a face as long as a wet week. "Well, why are you so cross, Whiskers?" asked the cat. "Well, who can be cheerful when he is out at elbows?" said the cat. "I'm getting on in years, and my teeth are blunted, and I prefer to sit by the stove and purr instead of hunting round after mice. And just because of this, my mistress wanted to drown me. I made myself scarce, but now I don't know where to turn." "Oh, come with us to Bremen," said the ass. "You're a great hand at serenading, so you can become a town musician." The cat consented and joined them. Next, the fugitives passed by a yard where a barnyard fowl was sitting on the door, crowing with all its might.
You crow so loud you pierce one through and through, said the ass. What's the matter?
Why, didn't I prophesy fine weather for Lady Day when Our Lady washes the Christ child's little garment and wants to dry it? But notwithstanding this, because Sunday visitors are coming tomorrow, the mistress has no pity, and she's ordered the cook to make me into soup. So I shall have my neck wrung tonight. Now I'm crowing with all my might while I can. Oh, come along, Redcomb, said the ass. You'd much better come with us. We're going to Bremen, and you will find a much better fate there. You have a good voice, and when we make music together, there will be quality in it. The cock allowed himself to be persuaded, and they all four went off together. They could not, however, reach the town in one day, and by evening they arrived at a wood where they determined to spend the night. The ass and the hound lay down under a big tree. The cat and the cock settled themselves in the branches, the cock flying right up to the top, which was the safest place for him. Before going to sleep, he looked round once more in every direction. Suddenly, it seemed that he saw a light burning in the distance. He called out to his comrades that there must be a house not far off, for he saw a light. Oh, very well, said the ass. Let's set out and make our way to it, for the entertainment here is very bad. The hound thought some bones or meat would suit him, too, so they set out in the direction of the light. They soon saw it shining more clearly and getting bigger and bigger till they reached a brightly lighted robber's den. The ass, being the tallest, approached the window and looked in. What do you see, old jackass? Asked the cock.
What do I see? Answered the ass. Why, a table spread with delicious food and drink, and robbers seated at it, enjoying themselves.
That would just suit us, said the cock. Yes, if we were only there, answered the ass. Then the animals took counsel as to how to set about driving the robbers out. At last they hit upon a plan. The ass was to take up his position with his forefeet on the window sill. The hound was to jump on his back. The cat to climb up onto the hound, and last of all, the cock was to up and perch on the cat's head. When they were thus arranged, at a given signal, they all began to perform their music. The ass brayed, the hound barked, the cat mewed, and the cock crowed. Then they dashed through the window, shivering the panes. Oh, the robbers jumped up at the terrible noise. They thought nothing less than that the devil was coming in upon them, and fled into the wood in the greatest alarm. Then the four animals sat down to table and helped themselves according to taste, and they ate as though they'd been starving for weeks. When they had finished, they extinguished the light and looked for sleeping places, each one to suit his taste. The ass lay down on a pile of straw, the hound behind the door, the cat on the hearth near the warm ashes, and the cock flew up to the rafters. As they were tired from the long journey, they soon went to sleep. When midnight was past, and the robbers saw from a distance that the light was no longer burning and that all seemed quiet, the chief said, "We ought not to have been scared by a false alarm," and he ordered one of the robbers to go and examine the house. Finding all quiet, the messenger went into the kitchen to kindle a light. And taking the cat's glowing, fiery eyes for live coals, he held a match close to them so as to light it. But the cat would stand no nonsense. It flew at his face, spat, and scratched. He was terribly frightened and ran away. He tried to get out the back door, but the hound, who was lying there, jumped up and bit his leg. As he ran across the pile of straw in front of the house, the ass gave him a good, sound kick with his hind legs. While the cock, who had awakened at the uproar, quite fresh and gay, cried out from his perch, "Cock-a-doodle-doo!" Thereupon the robber ran back as fast as he could to his chief and said, "There's a gruesome witch in the house who breathed on me and scratched me with her long fingers, and behind the door there stands a man with a knife who stabbed me, while in the backyard lies a black monster who hit me with a club, and upon the roof the judge is seated," and he called out, "Bring the rogue here!" So I hurried away as fast as I could. Thenceforward, the robbers did not venture again to the house,
which pleased the four Bremen musicians so much that they never wished to leave it again. You've been listening to stories from the Illustrated Treasury of Children's Literature, edited by Margaret Martignoni and published by Grosset and Dunlap. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The executive producer is Carla Tonella, and I'm Ellen Whitcher.